Hello, and welcome back for another affiliate-focused branch of the UF Care Podcast. These are conversations with early career professionals studying addiction research here at the University of Florida, as well as providing advice and support for those entering the field. My name is Victor. I'm a rising third-year graduate student here in the Department of Clinical Health Psychology, working with Dr. Jeffrey Boisenow. And today we're joined by Bo Sortman. Welcome, Bo.
Hi, Victor. Thanks for inviting me on.
Of course. How's your day going so far?
Excellent. Yeah, it's been a good day in the lab. I just got back from a vacation, so it's good to be back in the lab.
Oh, that's excellent. Where'd you go?
I went to California. I'm from California, so I was visiting some family for a couple of days.
That's awesome. Well, hopefully you're feeling refreshed. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today. I guess just to start, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I am, I guess, a rising third year myself. Is that what it means? I'm going to be starting my third year in the fall.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm a graduate student in the Department of Pharmacodynamics in the College of Pharmacy. So my PhD will technically be in pharmaceutical sciences. I got my bachelor's degree from California State University, Long Beach in California, of course. And there I was studying psychology. I was a late starter with school. I didn't go back to college till I was 25. And I just didn't want to leave. So here I am.
Here you are.
Yeah.
It's good to have you here.
Thanks.
So Bo, could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the Department of Pharmacodynamics? Like, what is the research that you're doing in pharmaceutical sciences? How do you spend your day?
Yeah. So I do a lot of similar things that I was doing when I was studying psychology, technically. You know, I'm studying to become a behavioral neuroscientist. And so I think that generally what I describe that to people, if they're not familiar with behavioral neuroscience, is that we are trying to look at biological correlates with behavioral outputs. So we may be interested in our lab, for instance, in drug self-administration. So this is a, you know, psychology concept where we use a term called operant conditioning to train a rat to press a lever and then receive a reward. And in our lab, that reward happens to be drugs of abuse like cocaine. We also give drugs like oxycodone. And we try to see what changes are happening in the nervous system as a result of this self-administration of these drugs. So more specifically, like in the Warren lab, what we're interested in are neuronal ensembles, which are thought to be the neurobiological basis of memory. And if you want to stop me at any point, just go ahead, but I'll just keep going.
No, so, I want to hear about these neuronal ensembles. Our brain is singing somehow.
Yeah. Mine's a few octaves low, but what neuronal ensembles are thought to be are where the memories are stored, or essentially how memories and learned experiences are exhibited. It's a big question in neuroscience, which is, you know, where is the memory? You know, is it in neuron A? I mean, how could you find a memory? It's such a confusing concept. And you know, consciousness in general is an extremely difficult concept to probe. But one idea is that memories are an emergent process when a group of neurons that have been previously activated to a given stimuli are reactivated to particular cues. So if you imagine like in the instance of the rat pressing the lever for cocaine administration, you have a bunch of different cells that are responsible for particular processes. So you have cells that are important for showing the rat that it's in a box of some sort. It can feel the metal grates on its feet. It can smell the bedding that we put in the bottom of the cage. It can see the light that's coming from the lever that it's about to press. You know, there's all these different neurological sensation and perception processes that are going on that are creating this experience for the rat. And then, of course, when the rat presses the lever, it gets some physiological feeling when it gets the cocaine, and the cocaine is affecting these dopamine neurons and increasing extracellular dopamine, which is, you know, causing the rewarding experience that the rat is feeling. It's when all of these neurons that are contributing to this experience are activated repeatedly and in synchronicity that we get the birth of the ensemble, which is that these cells have now been wired together in such a way that if you were to activate one of them, you'll get the activation of all of them. So this is kind of the basic neuroscience 101 concept that neurons that fire together wire together.
Interesting. So I'm trying to rationalize this and understand it in my head. So in like a operating sort of way, like the screen in front of me that we're doing this over Zoom, the screen in front of me has a bunch of pixels, and each individual pixel is going to flash, you know, a color, but put all the pixels next to each other and I see Bo. Is that what you mean by like emergent?
Well, I mean, yeah, like the image, it's actually, I mean, like if we're talking about what you're seeing on the screen, we're just looking at light on the screen. You need a lot of other processes to have that emergent qualia that Bo is a concept that you can understand or even comprehend. You know what I mean? So it's like you see all the light, and then you have all of these neurons that are activating in your all these cells that are activating in your retina that'll eventually go to your visual cortex and then produce some kind of emergent concept in your brain, which is this, you know, thought that is, okay, I'm looking at Bo now. But essentially it's all of these cells that are working together that are creating this thought or this concept, or this, in our case, we are interested in memory. Mm-hmm. And if a fundamental piece of this as well is that there are a lot of cells that are potentially going to be activated at any given time point. So you have a lot of cells that could be activated when you look at the screen and you see some kind of light that's, you know, bouncing off of a rod or a cone, you know, causing this cascade of transduction from some physical thing, which is a ray of light, into an electrical and then chemical signal in your brain. But there's only going to be a certain number of these cells that become important after repeated activation. So that's kind of a key point as well in the ensemble hypothesis, is that, you know, previously the way that neuroscience was done was by ablating or destroying, or through clinical accidents where people would lose large portions of their brain. And then we would see some kind of change in their behavior. And we say, okay, well, it seems like the cortex is necessary for emotional regulation. Because when Phineas Gage, you know, which is a very common psychological,
if you weren't going to say it, I would have.
yeah. Phineas Gage, we all know he had a piece of metal go through his head, and then he became very mean, and he was a different person. So it's kind of we had this idea that, you know, broad structures of the brain are necessary for particular behavioral outputs. But what we found out as neuroscience technology becomes more precise is that it's actually small subsets of cells that are mediating these behaviors. And so you can have a higher, holistic understanding of what the cortex is for when you are thinking about it in the concept of ensembles compared to just region-wide manipulation of behavior.
How do you even begin to study this?
Yeah, it's well, I mean, like I said, up until fairly recently, it's been impossible. Mm-hmm. This concept was first thought of, the concept I'm talking about, ensembles, was first thought about in the early 1900s. I think that it was brought about before 1949, but the person that we normally attribute this to is Donald Hebb. And he wrote a book called On the Organization of Behavior in 1949. And this is where he's laying out his thesis for neural ensembles. And for many, many years, there was no way to actually test this hypothesis, because, again, how are you to determine where a memory is and which cells are necessary for a particular type of behavior? So again, it starts off with region-wide inactivations or clinical accidents where we see that somebody has lost some important function after having damage to a particular area of the brain. In preclinical models, it starts getting deliberate. So there was exocytotic lesions done to animals, you know, various regions of animals' brains. And then it developed into pharmacology. So we would use like GABA agonists, which are, GABA is the main inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. And so if you agonize these receptors, then you'll get a loss of function of this particular area of the brain if you're giving them these drugs. And then finally, we get to the real fancy, fun stuff that we're doing today, which is generally either chemogenetic or optogenetic manipulations. And what both of these systems rely on is implanting synthetic receptors into an area of the brain that we're interested in. And these synthetic receptors can either increase action potentials or decrease action potentials. I'm simplifying it, but broadly, this is what's happening.
Right.
And what that means is that you're going to get either a higher function of this area or a lower function of this area. Now, to get even more specific, because again, what I said previously is that if we are thinking about huge regions of the brain, if you were to inhibit an entire region, like the medial prefrontal cortex, or if we're getting more specific areas that I'm interested in, like the prelimbic and infralimbic cortex, if you were just to inhibit that entire area, people were getting different results. Different results, meaning that we used to think that the prelimbic region was for some particular behavior, and then someone got contradictory results. So how do we resolve this? Well, the ensemble hypothesis is a good way to resolve it, because what we can say is that, well, it's not really that the prelimbic region is just for behavior X. The prelimbic region is possible of behaviors X, Y, and Z. And we can show that by targeting ensemble cells specifically. Okay, now I say all that. I'm sorry if I'm rambling too far, but I say all that to preface what this technology is using, mm-hmm. which is we can target cells that are activated as a result of a particular behavior, and we can destroy only those cells instead of the entire brain region.
Oh, so it's targeted.
It's targeted. So when Extremely. We take the animal, we train them to get a lever press for cocaine, then we put them back into that environment where they learned this behavior, and we can target the cells that were activated in when the animal was in that particular environment. Instead of just inactivating the entire prelimbic or infralimbic cortex disease, we can just do the cells that were activated in that particular moment. And the way that we do that is because we target a particular protein that is a marker of neuronal activity called FOS. And FOS is a cool protein, because everyone realized, a decade ago or so, maybe more now, that, you know, when you have a particular behavior, then you'll get elicitation of this protein. So everyone's really excited about it, but nobody knew what it meant. You know, what exactly does it mean? And so I don't know who exactly discovered how to do this, but somebody figured out how to develop tools that are FOS specific, so you can then target these activated groups after a behavior, and then, you know, ablate, or if you're using some kind of chemogenetic or optogenetic technology, you can actually either silence them or you can increase their activity.
I think that the scientist, her name was Donna Foss, and that's,
oh, cool.
That's why it's called, I don't know.
Oh, you had me going. I was like about to believe that and then start telling people about it.
A lot of this is way over my head, but it sounds so cool, Bo. So you're able to target these specific neurons in the brain of these mice to target yes. this activity, this trained activity. So what can you learn from that? How does that apply to the research that you are doing as part of this program?
Well, what I'm doing in particular is using... So I don't want to go down the rabbit hole too far, but essentially the way that we can do this is through virally mediated tools. So we will inject a particular virus that under certain circumstances will elicit this protein that we can then monitor afterwards. So we can, you know, have cells that were necessary for this behavior turn green, or we can have them turn red, you know, and then we can measure that through microscopy later on. Mm-hmm. That's one leg of my research, which is looking at cells that are necessary for early learning in cocaine self-administration. Okay. Another area that I'm probing is what happens if you destroy these cells at different time points, because if we think that ensemble cells are mediating behavior, there's still a lot of things that we don't understand about how the ensemble is formed, how it maintains itself over time, and whether or not the cells that were initially important are still important later on. So that's one thing that I'm doing right now, is destroying cells that were initially important and seeing if they're still important at a later time point. That's another leg of the project. But I think that maybe the more interesting question about all of this is how it relates to when I'm more excited about talking to people about this that are not, you know, my mentor and the two other people that talked to me about it, is just like how learning and memory is mediated is still such a kind of an unknown when we're talking neurologically. You know, there's a lot of psychological concepts that we can rely on, but when we're talking about the biological changes that are occurring, it's very exciting to be probing this, because this hypothesis, potentially the ensemble hypothesis that is, could potentially solve a lot of you know, questions that are right now difficult to answer. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll leave that up to you, Bo.
No, thanks.
Sounds like sounds like you got a firm grasp on the concept.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I hope that it's just because it's a lot of my mentor repeatedly explaining it to me, and then mm-hmm. and then going back mm-hmm. to the literature and figuring it out. But initially, I think he explained what an ensemble was when I met him at Society for Neuroscience about 5-6 times before it sunk in. So
that leads to my next question, which is, how did you get into this lab? How did you get into this line of work? So you met Dr. Warren before applying to this program.
Yeah, I met Dr. Warren at Society for Neuroscience, I believe in 2018, which is just the biggest conference for neuroscience generally. And he knew my mentor at my undergrad institution, Arturo Zavala. We talked for a little bit, and he told me that he just started up his lab, and that he was looking for graduate students, and that I should come down for an interview during the next cycle. I was applying to PhD programs, and so I was very happy to meet him, because it actually worked out very well coming down to Florida. The program is very enticing, and I was applying to psychology programs predominantly, and this was a program in pharmaceutical sciences, which paid a lot more, which was nice. And also me and Brandon just got along very well from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So that was helpful. Yeah.
There's a lot of networking and research. I feel like networking is not talked about so much, but it is not so much what you know that is a vital piece to it, but it's also a lot of who you know and how you can make those connections and interact with people interpersonally, such as at mm-hmm. conferences.
Yeah, I think it's huge. I think it is probably the single most important aspect of getting into grad school, at least when we're talking about PhD. I don't know about med school and other grad professional degrees, but my experience with PhD is that the network that I developed in my undergrad institution was integral to me getting to this PhD program. And going to conferences as an undergrad was extremely important. My mentor really emphasized the importance of networking. I was going to several conferences by myself, even when I didn't have posters to present, just to try to meet PIs that I was interested in working with, which they always find very impressive if you tell them that you're an undergrad and you're following them. Well, maybe you shouldn't follow them too much, but if you go to a well-known conference, you know, and you say, "Hey, I'm a fan of your research, and I sure. wanted to see what was going on. I was really excited about this talk that you gave." That goes a long way in helping them sift through the couple, you know, dozens to hundreds of applications that they're going to receive.
Absolutely. It's nice to hear that someone is following your career, someone who is impressed by the work that you're doing. And wants to follow in the same footsteps.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It also helps you, I think, as well, to understand what is happening more broadly in science. I think that before I got to my four-year university, I transferred from a community college to the four-year university I got my bachelor's in. I had no idea what science was or what scientists did or what communication of science looked like. And also scientists were very scary to me too, before I came back to school, because I'm the first person in my family to get a four-year degree. Mm-hmm. And certainly no one in my family has had any history with science or knows anything about it. So I was really afraid of scientists or the idea of scientists before I got involved and found out that, you know, scientists are normal people. And this is just happens to be their job. It's a very good job to have, but it's just another career path that somebody took. So
speaking of career path, Bo, what is next for you? Do you have a 5-year plan, 10-year, 20-year plan? What's the future hold in store?
Definitely don't have a 20-year plan. Right now I'm just trying to get these viruses to work properly. That's what I'm thinking of right now. More after grad school, I think that where I'm at right now, my dream would be to help mentor students at a smaller institution than one like University of Florida. I think that the kind of research that goes on at these institutions are, it's the cutting edge of science, and it's beautiful research that could not be done at the kind of institution that I got my bachelor's degree in. However, my undergraduate research experience was so important to me and such a path to a career that I didn't know would be possible for somebody like me. So, you know, I think that I would prefer to go to a predominantly teaching university that has some ability to do research. I still want to do research, but I would like to be able to mentor, you know, master's students and undergrad students to kind of do for them what my undergraduate mentor did for me.
I think that's fantastic, Bo. And I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Victor.
We got a few years, but I'm optimistic for you. I think the way that you've described the concepts just in our brief conversation today, it was clear. You took the time to make sure that topics were understood and understandable. So if that speaks to your future as a mentor, then it's going to go well.
Thanks, Victor. I appreciate that.
Of course. So speaking of mentoring, the last question that I like to talk about with people on this program is advice. So we have these conversations not just so that we can show off the cool work that we're doing here, but also so that folks who are younger, early career, and even before that can look back and get some advice as to how they could move forward. So, Bo, if you had a piece of advice to tell a younger version of yourself or someone still in undergrad or high school, what chunk of your wisdom would you pass on?
I think the most important thing is that you're doing something that you're interested in and that you love. I mean, for me, research and learning and explaining things was just automatically fun for me. I really loved to learn something and then be able to explain it to other people, which is kind of what the job of being a scientist is. It's like you never stop learning. So I think that if you're doing something because you think you have to, or because this is the path that you know you've been on. I mean, originally I wanted to be a therapist and I wanted to be a counselor. That was why I went to school and why I was getting a bachelor's degree. But I realized that, you know, I actually don't think that I want to do that. And I had gotten involved with this research with my undergraduate mentor. And I thought, wow, actually, I think that this path is much more in line with my skills and what I would be happy doing. So I guess experiment a lot too, I think is also very important. You know, don't be in such a rush. I'm 31. I went back to school when I was 25, which I think was a good thing for me. And I hear a lot of undergrads who are 20, 21, 22, who just feel like they're running out of time. You know, they're on this predetermined path to some kind of degree, you know, being a lawyer or a doctor or a scientist or something. And they just feel like there's not enough time to explore and to see if this is actually the career path that they actually want. And I think that that it's imperative that you don't just do something because you think that you're supposed to. Because if you do not love it, this is a lot of work and it is not worth the money. Certainly, you know, it's not worth it if you don't really like it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's my, after school special advice. Mm-hmm.
A researcher telling people to experiment. Ugh, how cliche.
That's funny. That's like,
well, I think that's the time that we've got today, Bo. I want to thank you again for talking with me. I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. I think this was a great conversation.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm.
I'd also like to thank the University of Florida Center for Addiction Research and Education, Dr. Oliver Grundman, Dr. Sarah Jo Nixon, Dr. Joanne Paris, and all of our mentors and future collaborators. Thank you.